Hello, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. It is March.
It is March. It is going to get very weird in college basketball very quickly. This is one of those seasons, I know we say it most years, but this is one of those seasons that you're really not going to know what's going to happen. And I think this one stands out probably the most since at least 2007, maybe 2006. Dan, you could tell me if I'm wrong there, just because of the amount of teams that could conceivably win it, the amount of teams that could conceivably make some noise in the tournament, and the fact that we don't have a dominant team. We don't even have a dominant like group of 3 to 4. This is, I'd say, a pretty wide open group of at least 12 to 16 that could very easily win the NCAAs right now.
Yeah, I think we're starting to see Kansas pull away as like the definitive number one team. And, you know, we've talked about them a decent amount the last couple of weeks. I think they're probably the most talented team. Obviously, they've had their NCAA tournament issues in recent years. But I really like their group. But outside of that, I mean, I think there's probably 9 or 10 teams that could still get a one seed. If everything breaks right. And I think, you know, there's plenty of other teams that seem to be putting it all together and look like contenders. So, yeah, I think, you know, there's a group of maybe even like 15 that none of them would surprise me if one of them came out and went the whole way. And a lot of them, I mean, I think it's a good year for Syracuse to be in the position it is. I mean, I'd much rather be among those teams battling for a one seed. But if you're going to be like a 7 or 8 that has some fatal flaws, but can, you know, go on runs like we've seen the team do at times this year and get really hot from three and have a couple of big playmakers put together huge games. This is the year to do it. So I think it's going to be a really interesting field. I'm incredibly excited for it to get started. And we actually technically in the broadest definition of March Madness, we have some fun, like Northeast tournament, and a couple other Ohio Valley tournament games tonight. So I always enjoy those tournaments when they get down to the championships just because the atmospheres are always crazy. So we're really, really getting into the thick of it here.
Oh, yeah. And those fun – I mean, obviously, I'm very glad that I'm a fan of a big school and a big school that's good at basketball. But it's a lot of fun to watch those smaller tournaments, especially because, yeah, you know, they understand just like we do. Like, that tournament is the only shot they have to get into the dance, even if they lose in round one. They got there, and it's a special experience for a lot of those kids. And that's why, you know, people just kind of fall in love with March Madness, even if they're casual basketball fans. I think you brought up a good point with Syracuse. I mean, whether we're 7 or 8 or 9 or whatever, I mean, you don't want to be on the opposite line of a 1 or 2, but, you know, this is probably the year that you know, you can afford to do it. And if you're hanging around any of those seeds, like, you probably have more hope than most years, especially with, you know, pretty flawed teams like Villanova hanging around the one line. Plus, Syracuse does two things that that really, really benefit you come the tournament. And again, we'll see in the ACC tournament, you know, how much that helps. But I can only think it's going to help in NCAAs should we make it, and hopefully we will. And that is play great defense. I know we're second in opposing field goal percentage in the ACC, and hit threes. And I know that threes are streaky, and sometimes the defense can look a little disjointed too, especially on the interior. But in general, you know, Syracuse has at least the recipe to put together something this year if it can just stay focused for a full 40 once it gets to the dance.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's going to be so matchup dependent this year. Like, I'm looking at Lenardi's most recent bracket, and he has this against Colorado in the first round. And, like, the name Colorado doesn't scare me really, but Colorado does two things. They rebound. They're number 3 in the country in rebounding. And they have 4 guys who shoot over 40% from 3. And as a team, they shoot 39.7% from 3. So those are both terrifying things. So I don't know if we match up well with Colorado, but I also, you know, the name Colorado, I haven't seen very much of them at all this year. Maybe you've seen more being out west, but like that shouldn't scare me. But then there might be, you know, a better team that just doesn't shoot well or doesn't rebound well and won't be able to take advantage of what Syracuse doesn't do well that, you know, SU could probably handle, even if they're a team that's like on the 4 or 5 line or something. So it's going to be one of those years where I mean, if anyone has anywhere near like a perfect bracket this year, good for them, because I don't think any of us are going to really have a great beat on what happens once Slush and Sunday rolls around and we see who is where.
No, I mean, there's so many teams it's going to be matchup dependent on. And I feel like it's increased in the last couple of years. The wrong teams get the wrong matchup, or in the case of the lower seeds, the right teams get the right matchup. For Syracuse, I think that's going to go double. Obviously, we can play with teams that might play to our weaknesses. I think North Carolina, we're going to wade into that game a little bit. North Carolina can play well in the middle, and I think we hung with them for much longer than we probably should have on Monday night. But the fact is we could do it. But at the same time, I don't trust Syracuse against a team that is bigger than them and more talented than them, or at least equally talented, as we see with teams like Pitt, perhaps. But in the case of North Carolina, more talented, more size. That's going to be a win every time. Syracuse cannot afford to, any year, but especially this one, I feel, lose the battle on the boards by much, if at all. A team like Colorado is a perfect example of someone who can just, they're not better, but they can shred us just based on a couple of glaring weaknesses that sometimes depth can make up for, or at least sometimes the length of bodies on the floor can make up for. This year, I feel like for rebounds, it's either all or nothing. Either Roberson shows up and Coleman contributes, or Roberson's a no-show and Coleman performs similarly.
Yeah, and UNC is like they don't do the three well at all. I mean, they hit a couple early, but they were 6 for 25, and that's just not their game at all, especially because Marcus Page has kind of been an enigma this year. He was 1 for 7. But their rebounding is so great, and their interior play just kills us. Like, we saw what happened in the game at the Dome, where they ran the same high-low action to that little short corner over and over and kept on killing Syracuse. And then, they didn't destroy us on rebounds because Roberson came to play for the first time in a while, but there was still an advantage there. And when you can rotate bodies in like that against SU zone, it's going to cause a lot of foul issues, especially with the refereeing crew we had the other night. It was kind of embarrassing. And how many fouls they called on both sides, and just there isn't a ton of depth on the orange bench, so it's going to be a struggle. Luckily, I don't think there's a team that has the number of quality bids that UNC does in the country, but there are definitely ones that will get after it on the boards just as well as they will, and there's plenty of teams that are going to be familiar with what SU does, so there are going to be some that we could play that will be totally flummoxed by SU, and there will be some that will be very competent on offense against the zone. So hopefully we find one of those lesser rebounding teams that forces bad jumpers. But it to go, I mean, good showing the ACC tournament. Syracuse did move its way up to like a 6, and if they lose the next 2 games, they could be out totally. So still a lot of basketball to play.
Yeah, and I think that the ACC, it's the same deal as what we were talking about with the NCAAs. I think for Syracuse, it's all about who you match up with. And obviously, there are no easy matchups in the league this year. But if you can avoid a team like Pittsburgh, perhaps, and stay out of their way, I think that, Pitt's not great, but they're just not a team that I want any part of. I feel like you look at a team like Notre Dame is really fading, and they're a team I'd love to kind of get yet another crack at. At this point, I think that, Clemson, same deal. They're definitely a team fading. I want no part of Virginia Tech. Florida State's going to be a really iffy proposition come Saturday, just because I think that I can't tell which direction they're going. I mean, that win over Notre Dame was huge. But at the same time, Notre Dame is definitely trending south. Florida State before that game was trending south as well. There's just a lot at stake for Syracuse, and I'm, again, just I feel like I just have to sit around and just wait for matchups, and I guess that's what's going to be really frustrating for a lot of Syracuse fans. We've been here before, and we'll, I'm sure, be there again as long as we're tied to the zone in any way, shape, or form. We're going to have to, unfortunately, play the matchup game more so than most years. I mean, Dayton was a perfect storm of a team that could beat us a couple years ago. It worked out for them. Many of us were probably rooting for Dayton against Ohio State in that first round game, and I think in hindsight, maybe Ohio State would have been the better opponent for Syracuse and its respective strengths that year. This year, it's like a little bit different mold that we're rooting against, but nonetheless, there are definitely some teams to watch out for, both within the ACC bracket, and again, I'm looking at UPitt, and then there's teams to watch out for in the NCAAs, which I think we'll have to kind of cross that bridge when we get there.
I like that you had like a very light criticism of the zone, and then it sounded like James Arthur was trying to abandon ship and run out of your house.
Yeah, he's playing with a blue dog at the moment.
Yeah, Florida State, actually, the Notre Dame win was their first win since they went to the Dome and got crushed by SU. Obviously, we've seen this play out a number of times. Just because SU killed a team one time at home doesn't mean that the same thing will happen in the return trip. So I feel good about the game, but just because Syracuse won by 13 the first time doesn't mean they'll do the same thing. And obviously, they're a much tougher team to play it on the road. So it's going to be a big one. Saturday's going to be crazy. There's so many big games across the whole college basketball world. But I will be very nervous during, like you said, on paper, SU should go in there and win and pick up win number 20 and look pretty good for the tournament. But obviously, things have not been that easy all year. So we will see.
No, I think what you expect from Syracuse is rarely what plays out on the court. That has both pluses and minuses. On the schedule overall, I think that college hoops finally kind of figured out, and maybe with the help of ESPN, maybe not, why college football is so successful, especially at the end of the year in terms of television ratings, rivalry week and all that. And I think that, having the season end with a lot of critical matchups and, teams that were or are likely to finish in similar places in their leagues and be, jockeying for conference tournament standing and NCAA tournament seeding, I think it's just it's a smart idea to, really just close the season on an exclamation point, especially considering, between the new shot clock and just a lot of parity, it just felt like a really fun and exciting season. Watching, I know I was saying to my wife the other day that like last couple of years, and you and I have talked about this, college basketball has been sort of unwatchable in the regular season. When we started really seeing these teams start to grind each other down, play a Virginia type game, and more teams were doing that and trapping too much and all that, and shooting poorly, and using defense to kind of balance that out. And the NBA was a much more watchable game. I think the NBA still is a little bit more watchable, but college has definitely redeemed itself in my eyes this year, and I find myself gravitating, especially as the Knicks continue to free fall, a lot more toward what college games are on television.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been like a totally different game, but it's definitely a nice uptick. And I like that college and the NBA are two different games. Like, they're very distinct sports now because of how wide open the NBA has become. College, not so much like college football, but there's still a wider array of styles and different looks to the team, where the NBA, everyone kind of is gravitating towards the Warriors, or they're not very good, which is fine, because it makes for a very aesthetically pleasing brand of basketball, and then obviously the Warriors are on all the time. You can always watch them and be entertained, because they're amazing. But yeah, whatever. They're fun to watch.
I was there when they were fun to watch and terrible. And then all the fans showed up once they were fun to watch and good.
Yeah, well, so is, sports in a non, with a non-power of house franchise. But I don't know. I kind of like the distinction. I like that I can watch a college game and it feels like a college game, and an NBA game feels like an NBA game. But that being said, I do prefer the college game in 2016 over what we were watching in 2014 and 15, and that's Syracuse included. Obviously, the 2014 was a much better one than this year, but at times, like, we were kind of grinding our teeth and being like, oh, yeah, it's so great, we're number one, and it's like, yeah, this is not the best product, except for Tyler Ennis was wonderful. But overall, I think the sport's definitely been improved by the changes they made this offseason.
Undoubtedly. So I guess, Dan, what is the one takeaway, one biggest takeaway that you can find from the North Carolina game? Obviously, Syracuse was down by a bunch. It looked like everything was hopeless. Then they kind of came out firing for a few minutes on end. Really seemed like they had a shot. They were obviously just down one. And then things kind of fell apart again. Not spectacularly, but they just kind of ran out of gas. So what was your biggest takeaway from that? And you can make that positive or negative depending on, you know, just kind of what your mood is at the moment.
I think it was encouraging that Syracuse could play with a team that is probably has a decent talent edge while not playing its best game. Syracuse obviously did not shoot well from three overall. 25%, 5 for 20 is pretty bad, especially because of the volume this team is forced to shoot. I think we're really seeing, I mean, Benajay has been amazing all year, but he's really like asserting himself now. It looks like he wants to make a run here. He had a great game individually. He didn't shoot well from deep, but overall, aside from, you know, it wasn't his most efficient outing, but he really like helped will the team back into it. Malachi had an interesting stretch, but wasn't great. Cooney wasn't great, but it was nice to see Roberson rebound literally and figuratively for the first time in what seems like 2 or 3 weeks. And I think they hung with a team that was doing a lot of things that Syracuse is really weak against, especially interior offense, where SU kind of has to just let people store at times because they have so little depth inside, and the foul situation was ridiculous overall. Just there was so little consistency with what was being called. But I don't know. I always, you know, it would have been nice to really lock up a tournament bid with a win, which I think would have done it. But I think going into the tournament where there are going to be matchups, I mean, if SU wants to make any kind of run, it's going to have to beat teams that have been better than it all year. And seeing the game at UNC, I mean, that game was very close. It was, what, a three-point game with a couple minutes left. So Syracuse could have pulled it out for sure. And going into it, or if you know, it asked me at halftime, I was like, yeah, it seems like UNC's going to run away with this one. And for a while there, at the beginning of the second half, it looked like that was exactly what was going to happen. But the team showed some spirit, which was good.
Yeah, and you know what? I think in general, it was a big positive to see Syracuse just do better than they really should have. I feel like, for the most part, like, you can look at the box score and say, oh, SU lost by 10, they won by 20, like, whatever it is, based on the quick glance of the box score. And I feel like this game, not so much. Benajay played a ton of minutes. As always, didn't shoot amazingly, but, you know, scored when it counted, and really was the only player on the floor that had a great game for Syracuse. And yet, I mean, and then you look at the disparity when it comes to rebounds, as always. You look at how poorly they shot from three. Look at the fact that they've shot oddly well from the free throw line, which trends positive. But, like, in general, like, you don't look at this box score and see a blueprint for, a close road loss against, you know, a top 10, potentially top 5 team. And that's, I guess, what's weird to me. I think that it's encouraging, like you said, that they can hang with a team like that. I don't necessarily think it's sustainable for more than a game or so in the tournament for Syracuse to be able to rely just on Benajay. I mean, again, these weren't complete no-shows by everybody else, but you can't really say that anybody else had a good game but him, and that's just unsustainable, especially from Cooney. If a guy's going to take 11 shots, you better hit more than three of them. He's, and we've talked about him, he stop and go, he can find ways to contribute in other ways positively. I'm not sold that he did a ton of that against UNC, other than those two steals that he managed. I'd say overall he probably is a player who's going to need to put up either more points than he did, and that was 14 in that one, so decent effort, but he's either got to put up more points or just be more effective and or efficient from the floor if he's not going to really have a great shooting day.
I did appreciate that he got himself to the line, and that was, you know, big, especially because they were calling everything. So he got Sitz's free throws. He made all of them. The team as a whole, like, actually hit its free throws, which was crazy. They were 19 for 23 overall. He kind of recognized that early and made that part of his game, because the shot obviously wasn't there. The shot hasn't been there for a while. So I hope we're due for a good Cooney stretch here in March, because we do need him to come around. He can do things that are good when he's not hitting shots, but he's, you know, totally changes the outlook of the team when he's able to, you know, knock down 40-50% of his shots.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that goes for Richardson, too, to be honest. I mean, we talked about him at length a couple weeks ago when, you know, SU was really, like, kind of trending positively. It seemed like Richardson's resurgence was a big part of it, that he was just playing, like, really, like, just really, really, really on point. And you had to love what he was contributing. I feel like, you know, he's kind of – he's hit a bit of a rough patch and a little bit of freshmanitis maybe. Frank Howard, I feel like, is just kind of he's not getting the minutes to be like a huge impact in the box score, but he's doing the little things, and I think hopefully we can see a little bit more of him you know, as the season wraps up, because I do think, you know, having him to kind of you know, grab some minutes and give Cooney, who's completely gassed at this point, and Benajay some rest, is much, much appreciated. So yeah, I think, yeah, if it's not Cooney, then I think Richardson in particular is somebody that needs to step up if SU has any shot of winning more than a game, if even that. And then, yeah, Frank Howard is another guy on this team who we probably are going to see more minutes from, at least if this team's going to be able to keep its legs for more than another week in this season.
Yeah, and I think we've seen some of that. I'm looking at Cooney's Dame log. Starting an ACC play, he played 40 minutes in the Pitt game. This is like that 40-game losing streak, 40, 35, 43 in the overtime game against Clemson, 39. BC, he got a little bit of rest. But now, the last couple weeks, he played 37 FSU, Florida State, and Louisville. And then the last three games, which Franklin Howard's been playing a lot in, 34 minutes against Pitt, 32 against NC State, 33 against UNC. I think if you get 32 good minutes out of Cooney, and hopefully that allows him to get his legs under him a little bit more, it would really benefit. And Howard, while he's not really a scoring threat, he actually had two nice buckets in UNC. He was 2 for 2. He's pretty safe with the ball overall. He doesn't seem to be making a lot of stupid mistakes. He is a really good passer. He plays good enough defense for a freshman who really didn't get a lot of run until really maybe the last month and a half. So I don't think he's going to be a game changer, but I do think if he can give Cooney, you know, a good 5 minutes of rest here and there, or even Benajay for a minute or two, I don't know how much we can afford that, but or Richardson a couple minutes, I think that could be a big impact. And you know, we can tell Boeheim kind of trusts him at least more than he usually does a freshman, because it doesn't seem like he's all that hesitant to put him in pretty big situations or in the middle of the game when things are still on the line.
Oh, yeah, and like you said, you know, it's the fact that he's not really much of a liability. He had two turnovers against UNC, but when you look at the other guards, I mean, Cooney had none, and there's the reason why Boeheim trusts him, even when the shot isn't falling. But Richardson had 4, Benajay had 7, which is a number I didn't really know until I looked at this game log a little bit. But yeah, I think that Howard's proven himself that he belongs on the floor due to the lack of mistakes. Now, again, like we said it when Howard was first getting more minutes, it's the fact that he's doing little things on defense, surprisingly, as a freshman, and then also doing you know, some more little things off the ball on offense that are really helping. I just think that, you know, if Frank Howard is the guy that we need to step up to make a tournament run, that might be problematic. And that's not a knock on him. It's more a knock on the construction of this team that we know we have a certifiable number one, but the guy who's playing the second banana role on this team is just so much in flux and sometimes non-existent that you sometimes get forced to, you know, go to your fifth or sixth scoring option. And that's, you know, a scary proposition for any team in the regular season, never mind a tournament.
Yeah, and we can't have it where Howard's taking a lot of shots. It's just not going to work. It's going to be the three guards doing what they do. If both Cooney and Malachi stay cold, it's not going to be a long march. But hopefully those two are due and break out here. And if not, we'll see everyone next year, because it can't just be Benajay. And there's not going to be like a walkover game. We're kind of not – we get used to like – being a 1, 2, or 3 seed a lot in the, not really a 2, we've been a 2, but we've been a 1 or a 3 or I guess 4 in the year we went to the Final Four. We've had some pretty easy games early on, even, you know, I forget who we played before Dayton, but it wasn't
Western Michigan.
Right, and that wasn't,
that was a laugher.
I mean, that was tougher than the Montana State game, but it wasn't much more than that. This year, it's gonna be all tough ones because Syracuse isn't exactly outclassing anyone on the 8-9 line. So, we're gonna need those guys to wake up real quick.
Right, and like you brought up a good point there. I think Syracuse fans in general, us included, have gotten a little too used to this kind of elevated station in life, based on not just quality regular season performances, but also like some really nice and surprising tournament showings that have maybe given them a better seed than one might have thought they were. I mean, the Big East tournament run in 08-09 definitely brought that team up a couple seeds. The obvious, the Jerry run in 05-06 did the same thing. These were teams that were either, hanging around the 8-9 line or lower. In the case of the 05-06 team, like potentially out. A nice run put them on a 5 line. And then obviously, again, the same thing with the 08-09 team, that they received higher seeds that might not have been indicative of the seasons overall, but were indicative of the overall body of work when you look at the conference tournament performance. At this point, we're looking at probably 10 years worth of SU fans getting overmatched opponents in round one. I mean, they've lost to a couple of them, looking at Vermont and Texas A&M in particular, but overall, SU has been favored heavily in its first round matchup now for 10 years straight, or at least in the tournaments we were in that stretch. And it's definitely definitely going to be a weird dynamic for a lot of us, especially those of us who weren't at school the last time we weren't favored, to see something a little bit different, barring us making the tournament.
Yeah, I mean, every time we've made it that I've been an SU fan, we've been a top four seed. So it's going to be a bit of an adjustment. And I think, hopefully if we made it to the second weekend, I think that would be a huge accomplishment for this team and something nice to build on. Obviously, that's asking a lot because there's a good chance we're playing a one or a two seed in the round of 32. But again, we'll see. I'm not going to automatically write the team off, but it's going to be interesting. We're not going to be able to pencil our way into the Sweet 16 this year, that's for sure.
No. And you know what? Like, it's weird. Rational me right now says, I'd be happy with Sweet 16. But at the same time, and you know how this works as a fan, rational me is going to go out the window if Syracuse can find its way past a one or a two seed in round two and get itself to Sweet 16. And I think all bets are off. Then I'm unfortunately, for my own, mental stability and health, thinking Final Four, just like most other fans, after the first two wins.
Yeah, I'm going to say I hopefully won't do that, but I know in the back of my mind I'll be like, yeah, but we could beat Kansas. I mean, why wouldn't we be able to beat Kansas? They lost to Oklahoma State that one time on the road. That was a thing that happened once. That wasn't something to it's not totally unreasonable to extrapolate that and say that Syracuse can upset the best team in the tournament.
No, of course. And you know what? I think it really, again, it's all about matchups. It's also about location. I know in some of the brackets that came out, we were a 9 seed. We were a 9 seed in Oklahoma's bracket, down in Oklahoma City. I mean, that's a loss. That's a loss not just because I think that Oklahoma's a great team, but also a loss because, that's a largely partisan crowd. I mean, it doesn't always guarantee a win, but when you have a team like Oklahoma that just seemed overwhelmingly talented, especially at one position in particular, it just seems like a recipe for disaster for Syracuse or any team that goes up against them. If, we face, let's say, USC as an 8 seed at the Garden and then move on to face Villanova, again, in front of a, heavily orange crowd, I mean, that's a recipe for a tournament upset, and maybe some people get pissed off about that because for some reason people think Syracuse is right next to New York City. Thank you, Dr. Gross. But in general, we're going to have to play a little bit of matchup and location. At the same time, Cal did not get right back in this when we were playing in San Jose, right near them, when they were a lower seed than us. And all that worked out for the better. And we played in the West and we played in D.C. And we managed to get ourselves to a Final Four just a couple years ago. I'm not saying everything hinges on location and matchups, but there's a decent amount of it that hinges on, especially the matchup part of that equation.
Yep. So get ready to convince yourself of a lot of different scenarios, because heading into the conference tournaments, I mean, it seems like we've been hanging around this like 8, 9, 10, I mean, pretty much since we got back into the tournament field. But the conference tournaments, I think could throw a total wrench into a lot of, you know, for a lot of these seeding lines, because like the Big 12, they have so many teams that are in like the top 4 or 5 seed ranges. I'm looking now, they have, I mean, their top 7 teams are all going to get in. That tournament could kind of lay waste to a lot of different things in terms of like where teams are projected to go now. And the ACC is kind of similar with, you know, 7 or 8 teams that are possible tournament teams vying for position. You know, if someone weird goes on a run, it can shuffle up a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, this is another thing that SU fans, and we're just about at halftime, SU fans need to keep in mind too, is that we're back to the weird place we haven't been in a while of just, you know, rooting against Cinderellas and rooting against some bubble teams. I know in the post I put up today, and for people listening yesterday, talking about SU's kind of bracketology projections, I also mentioned a bunch of teams that we might be wanting to root against. Some of those have realistic, you know, options to play their way in. Others, not as much. I think Florida is one team. You know, they got like 14 losses already. They'd have to get to at least the SEC semifinals with a big upset on the resume if they have any shot. It isn't large at this point. But yeah, I think SU is going to have to do a lot of tournament watching. I mean, granted, they can also, they still, just like a lot of other teams, have control their own fate. If Syracuse can, you know, beat a team like Georgia Tech, and then beat a team like Notre Dame, I mean, they're in. I think if they beat Georgia Tech, they're probably in. If they beat Georgia Tech and Notre Dame, they're definitely in. They can go further than that. Now we're suddenly talking about maybe elevation to a 7 seed or a 6 seed, you know, depending on what happens next. I think this team could probably get as high as a 5, depending on who they beat in the ACC tournament. I think there's enough that, you know, that means also that nobody else got upset except the teams in our way. We were able to beat, you know, a 2 or 3 top 20 teams en route to a championship. I'm not predicting that. I'm not expecting that. But just painting a picture for folks of, like, what's the absolute highest they can climb.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right, assuming, like, not total mayhem happens otherwise. But I mean, so many of these tournaments, like at the top, like I said, the Big 12, that's all going to be tournament teams playing each other, unless like Oklahoma State or Kansas State makes a run. So a lot of them might just be rearranging deck chairs. But I think 5 sounds about right if Syracuse is to make a run. And I think just like 1 win of the next 2, I think, should seal it for us in terms of just making the field. I feel pretty good about not being too nervous on Selection Sunday, as long as we get like 1 more win, hit 20. 2 more wins, I think we're like golden, and no more, and things might get interesting.
Right, and yeah, things can get very interesting, very scary in that regard. I think, I know TeamRankings.com said 22 wins, and there's like a 90% shot we're in. I think it might be a little bit higher than that in my mind, but even if we're going to play that game, I think 2 more wins should be enough. Obviously, if it's against Florida State, and then, you know, whoever we'd face in our first matchup in the ACC tournament, I think that would seal the deal, because I don't think anyone would really fault us for like a quarterfinals or so matchup. Quarterfinals or so loss in the ACC tournament, but if we happen to lose to Florida State and then win a couple games in the ACC tournament, I think that would do the trick just as well.
Yep, I think we're on the same page there.
Good deal. And on that note, let's talk about some beer. Dan, what have you been enjoying?
Not a ton of exciting stuff the last couple of weeks. Hasn't been a big drinking week. I enjoyed some kind of average stuff, like some Yinglings during the Oscars. Always a drinkable event to get through a lot of the boringness and also the awkwardness this year. The one nice thing I did get was a random free pitcher of Omegang Wit during the UNC game because of strange pouring error on the part of the bar I was at, so that was fun. And that, you know, was one of my standbys up in Syracuse. And then now, like, I feel like I had so much of it then that I often pass on it, but it was by far the best option for me on Monday, and I was reminded why I like it so much. It's a great beer, so I enjoyed that.
Nice, and obviously helps to have something to wash the pain away when when Syracuse loses.
Oh yes.
some of mine this past week, talked about it a couple weeks ago, but had it in bottles this time around. It was the brewery's La Ronces, raspberry sour blonde, very, very good. Like I said, even better in bottles. Had Buried Hatchet from Southern Star Brewing down in Texas, and then had the bourbon barrel aged version called Black Crack. Very, very good stuff. Definitely drank a lot easier than the 11% and change it was. Had the brewery, so happens it's Tuesday. It's kind of like a toned-down version of the famed Black Tuesday. It's around 14%. Good drink for a Friday night. Saturday had some Monkish Black Kisses. It's a blackberry and a blackcurrant sour. And then also had, over at Abigail Brewing, it's not too far from here, I talk about it here and there. Had the By the Bay IPA. That was good, it wasn't amazing, but it was a good drink to just have out. And then I also had Alesmith IPA. For some reason, before the Oscars, I was kind of craving a fresh IPA to enjoy during the event. And surprisingly, I'm getting a little annoyed by this, that there just wasn't a ton of like fresh stuff around. Luckily, found a six-pack of Alesmith, was able to enjoy that. Otherwise, I would have gone... We're rummaging for something else, but yeah, I was startled by the lack of fresh options, especially from the local breweries, kind of hanging around on shelves last weekend.
Good stuff.
Yeah, and on that note, let's talk bracketology, and then we can switch over to football a little bit. So let me open that up, making for some great radio.
I'm actually ahead of you this week. I'm all prepared and
stuff.
Look
at this guy.
I'm finally learning what we do every week during from like February on.
Well, it took like 3 years, but we got there. All right. For some reason this opened the January 25th bracketology.
Yep, that happened. That just ESPN killing the SEO game.
Yeah, they're the best. All right. So, March 2nd, bracketology. This bracket has us in it. So, looking at the Midwest first, I got Kansas. I got Colorado beating us for the aforementioned reasons. Iowa's a tire fire, so I got Duke. I got Duke losing to Kansas in the Sweet 16. Then on the other end, as much as I want to pick a thorough creening on that side, I'm picking Indiana and I'm picking Kansas over Indiana, and what should be a really fun Elite Eight game were it to happen.
Yeah, I have the same thing. I kind of want to pick like Wichita. I'm not buying into Wichita this year. I think one of the interesting maybe lower seeds, Oregon State's playing like really surprisingly under the radar to basketball. I don't think they're going to beat... They might be Notre Dame. I don't think they'll beat Indiana, because I'm kind of buying Indiana this year, which is weird to say and uncomfortable. But like you said, I think Kansas... I said early, like Kansas just looks like they kind of hit a place where they're kind of rising above the rest of college basketball right now. Obviously, that could come crashing down to earth because, you know, Bill Self does not have the best tournament record, unlike his pretty impeccable regular season record. But this year's team, like, they have three really dynamic guards. They have a great forward. They have some good depth. They have two, like, highly recruited, like, five-star freshmen that barely play. So who knows if one of them breaks out. I really like the Kansas team, so I have them going to the Final Four.
It's a fair point. You brought up a good point with Oregon State, too. I think in a different – if they can beat – well, I don't think Gonzaga's going to make it. But if they can beat Gonzaga in a potential matchup between 11s in the play-in game – I think they're a lock to beat Notre Dame based on the way the Irish have been trending. The Beavers have definitely played really well. I think Gary Payton has been is finally rounded into the player I think a lot of people thought he was going to be for the Beavs. And yeah, if Indiana moves somewhere else, Oregon State is one play-in team a year kind of makes it to at least the Sweet 16. I think that streak's still going. And I think Oregon State would be a prime candidate for that spot this year.
Yeah, they're an interesting team. That actually wouldn't shock me if they end up, you know, if they have a nice little run in the Pac-12 tournament, they could move their way up to like a 10.
Yeah, I think all they had to do was fire Barack Obama's brother-in-law. And suddenly Oregon State's good at basketball.
Thanks, Obama.
Perfect. Moving over to the East, Pitt USC is just a – those two teams right now, I don't – if another 8 or 9 were there, I'd say that Villanova was looking perilously down the barrel of the upset gun once again. I think Nova can get out of that first weekend, though, based on how those two teams have been playing. Maryland's in a free fall. A&M's holding steady. I think Maryland can turn it around. I don't think they can turn it around enough to beat Nova, though, which suddenly has Nova in the Elite Eight. Down on the other end, you can pencil in Monmouth as an upset over Arizona. West Virginia, despite Hofstra being very good, I've got West Virginia getting out of that bottom part with some ease. I mean, Miami's very good, and I wouldn't doubt them being able to do it either, but I've got West Virginia over Villanova in the Elite Eight here with an asterisk that Miami could also slot in somewhere.
This is like the ultimate ugly basketball bracket. Villanova plays okay basketball. They're kind of fun to watch. Pitt USC is not a fun game. I do think I agree. Nova, that's like not a bad draw for them. I think there are way worse 8-9 draws than that. Just in terms of Pitt, you know, they rebounded a little bit, but then they lost tonight to Virginia Tech, which is a bad loss when you're trying to make the tournament. Not that Vontech's that bad, but you know, you want to separate yourself from a 17-13 team. I like A&M in the top half. I just think they played pretty steady ball. They hit a little bit of a rough patch. And it feels like they've definitely rebounded. They beat Kentucky recently. I feel like they had hit a really high point where people were finally paying attention to them right before they started losing games. And now it's taken a while for the college basketball world to like repay attention to them. I think maybe they're a little underseeded at 5, honestly. They're a really steady, nice team. So I'm going to take them out of the top half. Maryland, like, they could come surging back, but it just seems like they've been trending downward for too long, so this might just be who they are. In the bottom, sticking with the ugly basketball thing, West Virginia, not a fun style. They are really, really physical. They will foul you a lot. They don't shoot the ball all that well, I believe, but they win. They're effective. I kind of like them coming out of the bottom, like you said. I think Arizona has a lot of talent, but they just haven't put it together in a couple weeks. Miami, I feel like they're maybe not quite as good as they've played. I think they've kind of outplayed where they are in terms of as a team, but they definitely deserve that 2 seed. But I'll take West Virginia and A&M, and I'm actually going to take A&M to go to the Final Four.
All right. Two teams that could have been in the SEC together if realignment had shook out differently.
I think West Virginia, I don't know if that's much better for West Virginia, though. At least not for football. Basketball, maybe.
Fair. All right, headed down south. UVA elevated to the 1 line. We know how we feel about UVA. I don't buy in on them as a 1, but I think they get out of the first weekend here. St. Joe's has really not been playing great lately. South Carolina's been playing even worse. So I got Virginia coming out of that top group. This Cal-Arkansas Little Rock game pisses me off because I'd really like to see both teams separately. I've got Cal, and then I've got Cal beating Virginia pretty handily over in the Sweet 16. Over on the other end, Utah has been playing really, really well of late. I'm going to go with Michigan State over them, but I don't like it. It's more just because of how Michigan State plays come March. Otherwise, I would definitely go with the Utes. So that leaves us with Cal and Michigan State. And I will go with Michigan State, despite me wanting Cal to get right back in this in the most biggest and notable way possible.
All right, so I'm going, if there are any Virginia fans listening, I apologize right off the bat. and you'll see why. I really like Virginia. I think I'm going to take them out of the top half. Cal is fun. Cal's been playing good ball. I think Cal's, you know, youth might hurt them in a matchup with Virginia just because that pap line defense is not a fun thing to play against for the first time. I also, as an aside, I might just pencil in Hawaii over Iowa State just to exercise those demons. In the bottom, Utah's been playing really good ball. Texas was playing really good ball for a while. I could see them losing to St. Mary's. I could also see them running St. Mary's out of the gym. I don't know which one I would favor. I'll take Utah in that little pod. And then, like you, I'm taking Michigan State, which means for the third year in a row, I am taking the Michigan State Spartans to beat the Virginia Cavaliers in the NCAA tournament. I'm so sorry, Virginia. I like your team. I don't mind that you play really ugly defensive basketball. I think I appreciate it. But sorry. It's destined. It's destiny. Like, Virginia and Michigan State, if they're seated in the same bracket, they will both make it to the Elite Eight, and Michigan State will ruin their year again for the third straight year.
Although, yeah, like, at least Michigan State this year would be, like, it wouldn't be that big of an upset.
It wouldn't be an upset at all. It's just, like, 3 years in a row losing to the same team in the tournament. Like, that's awful.
Agreed.
That's so brutal.
It's Michigan State, and, like, Michigan State doesn't deserve what it's had of late, or just any time during the Izzo era, other than the year that they won it all. They just happen to get lucky the other times. I know that that's a lot coming from me, always claiming the teams get lucky and then celebrating the fact that Syracuse got very lucky 1 year to get to the Final Four. I make the rules on this podcast, and I'm allowed to do that. I think Michigan State has been in our projections every week since we started doing this, at least a month ago. That's troubling, but also the realities of the world we live in.
They're really good. I mean, Valentine is playing out of his mind lately since basically they had that midseason swoon after they were like the number one team in everyone's everything, and he was player of the year, and then he got hurt and they disappeared for like a month, and now he's playing, like, I looked it up today, he's averaging something like 22-8-8 or something close in the last 10 games, and he might jump Buddy Hield for player of the year. I don't know, it might be too late because Buddy Hield kind of got the traction in the media pretty early, and he might just coast all the way there. Not coast, he's playing great, but he's just a ridiculous all-around player. And then Brid Forbes today, he hit 11 threes, he's shooting 50% from three, Aaron Harris is really good, Matt Costello's a nice player, like, they're just a really good, well-rounded team. And I won't join in on the Michigan State tournament slander. I think Tom Izzo's a very good tournament coach.
He is, I just also think there's a little bit of luck involved.
There always is.
All right, headed out west. North Carolina does not have an issue with Texas Tech if they get through, but Vandy has suddenly become very upset-minded. I still like North Carolina to get through there. I think Valpo upsets Purdue. I think that Kentucky has kind of slowed down a little bit, but against any of the other number ones, I'd probably pick Kentucky, but against North Carolina, I don't buy it. I got the Tar Heels in the Elite Eight. Down at the other end, the fact that Butler or Michigan could be in this field is laughable, so Baylor gets through, and they beat Oregon too, because I don't buy the Ducks at all. I got Wisconsin beating Providence, but not Oklahoma. I got Oklahoma over Baylor in what is a way too early Sweet 16 matchup between teams in the same conference. And then I got North Carolina over Oklahoma, despite my better judgment, setting up a Final Four for me of Kansas, North Carolina, West Virginia, and Michigan State.
I am going to take Kentucky over North Carolina.
All right.
This isn't one of the Kentucky teams of the last couple of years where they have just all kind of bigs, but I think they have enough size where they can kind of deal with UNC's three really good bigs. Stalabissier has been pretty bad this year, but he actually showed some life against Florida. And then they obviously need Derek Willis back, so that this is kind of hinging on him recovering from his, I believe, ankle injury. I'm taking them out of the top part. I agree with you on Baylor over Oregon. I'm going to take Oklahoma out of the bottom. I'm going to take Kentucky to go to the Final Four again, and I don't love doing it just because it's Kentucky. But Tyler Ulis and Jamal Murray are probably the best overall backcourt in college basketball. They haven't gotten a lot of help from the rest of the team. But when you have two guards that could just go nuts on any given night, I think that trumps a lot. They have a coach who knows how to get his team there. And it's just, I think this road isn't all that. I mean, it could be a lot worse. I think the matchups are not bad for Kentucky. Oklahoma, Buddy Hield can beat anyone by himself. So obviously it wouldn't be that much of a surprise if he went and dropped 35. You know, he has a lot of size on Ulis. I'm guessing they would use Murray to guard him. Oklahoma's a really well-rounded team. They're not playing their best basketball right now, but they could easily rebound. But right now I'm going to take Kentucky. I think that backcourt is just incredibly good. And I think in the tournament, you know, having two guards that can take over is big. So I have Kansas, Kentucky, A&M, and Michigan State, which is, aside from A&M, that's a very pretty predictable Final Four in a very unpredictable year.
Yeah, mine was too, actually. And I guess this is the bummer of these things. I mean, last year we said super unpredictable, and then we ended up with, like, a very kind of blue blood bracket. These things just sort of happen. I mean, the sports just, at the end of the day, college basketball made it look a little bit more wide open than college football. We don't have to dig in this because I know we did already a couple weeks ago. But at the end of the day, people still expect and like to see those blue bloods at the top line, and they usually are.
Yeah, I mean, it bears out in the ratings. Like, the first weekend, you always want, like, the crazy upsets, and having a bunch of those is fine. But whenever there's, like, I feel like the ratings are always better when they're the blue bloods. And, you know, people like rooting against Kentucky. They like rooting against Kansas. Kansas hasn't really been that far into it, so it hasn't really played in that much lately. But if Kentucky went on another run, like, it would, the hype train would be out of control. Kentucky-Kansas matchup in the Final Four, I know they just played earlier this month or in February. Two of the best backcourts in college basketball. That would be fun. And A&M, they're an interesting team. We saw them. We beat them, which is still our best win, probably. Or at Duke at this point. But they're an interesting group, and I think they'd be a fun underdog story. And then Michigan State, Tom Izzo just does what he does. So I think it would be a pretty interesting one in mine. But there's a lot of, like, really fun teams that could make for interesting matchups. So we are so close.
Very, very close. And I'm looking forward to what happens next. Before we close out, I want to touch a little bit about football. That's the focus for Dan and I for the most part during the year, during the off season. I think we don't really talk about basketball at all during the off season. Pretty much just focus in on football. And figured do a little bit of that here. Since spring practice is ongoing. So Dino Babers today, in an article by Chris Carlson, was talking about how the hybrids are all going to be sorted into actual positions, probably after the scrimmage on Saturday. Was that surprising to you? Do you disagree with anywhere that the three players in particular were being sorted, or do you think it all kind of makes sense?
I think it makes sense. It's interesting because we really didn't know how it was going to work out. And with guys, I mean, I think we've just kind of fallen into, like, being used to these guys being used in the way they've been under McDonald and Lester. But, I mean, looking back at Bowling Green, I mean, they have different guys within those position groups that have specific roles. But it does seem like their running backs are running backs and their receivers are receivers. So I think having some clarity as to the role would be good. Personally, like, I still am on the Irv Phillips is a better running back than receiver banner. But I trust Dino to, you know, make the right decision there. He knows, like, there's so much more about offense than I do. And maybe there's just more openings at the receiver position. So it's just, you know, a better way to get the best athletes on the field. But I'm fine with it. I think, obviously, the hybrid thing had so much hype in the last 2 years and never really developed into something that was great for any of those players. I'm excited to see Dante Strickland. I think every time he touched the ball last year, it seemed like he was ready to do something electric, and we just never gave him the ball because that seemed too logical. So having him at running back, obviously now there's a couple more carries to go around because Devontae McFarland is leaving the program. Best of luck to him. I think it's fine. It makes more sense now hearing that than when it seemed like we were just going to have more, you know, hybrids in the offense again and trying to figure out where that fit in.
Yeah, I mean, I still think that you could end up with, you know, running backs a little more pass catching, looking specifically at Strickland, and maybe Tyrone Perkins. You're looking at, you know, wide receivers, they're going to operate more out of the slot. I think Irv is definitely going to be penciled in there, but a slot guy, he's going to end up going deep a bunch too, based on Faber's feedback, Irv's feedback, as well as Steve Ishmael's now regular feedback on just everything Syracuse football. I think that I do agree with you. I'd be curious to switch Irv and Strickland. I think that Strickland was a little bit better of an option catching the football, and Irv is just such a great running back. But I, you know, again, Babers has forgotten more football than I'll ever know, and that's fine. And he can, you know, he can run the team the way he wants and the way he chooses. And I do trust him with his decision, and I'm sure most others feel the same way. I think it's going to be interesting to see how these carries shake out now in the backfield. As you mentioned, Devonta McFarland's gone, but I never really understood what role he was supposed to play out of, like, the backs. I think that Jordan Fredericks, while he might have had the fat back nickname, I don't buy him as a short yardage option all that much, which leaves us with either Joel Shaw, the true freshman who will be arriving this summer, or I don't know. I guess we're giving it to George Morris. I don't think Jacob Hill's an option there. I like Jacob Hill a lot. I think he's he adds fun personality to the team, but I'm not really banking on him being as large of a contributor this year as he might have been last year, injuries aside. So yeah, I think that the way those carries shake out now, between Morris, Fredericks, and Strickland, is going to be very interesting, and again, more so even when Shaw shows up and we see if the tank package returns or if it's just kind of retired for good.
Yeah, I mean, I think Fredericks is probably the most logical person as being more of a power back that's on the roster now, but I think he's more he's more well-rounded than that, so I'd like to see him in spread packages, see him in the regular open field offense. But like you said, there really wasn't a lot of room for McFarland. Who knows? I mean, Fredericks was great last year. I think people kind of almost forgot about how good he was, considering like how good Dungy was in his, you know, what, half a season of playing without injury. But he was kind of a revelation as a running back, so I'm looking forward to see the next what he's doing next. I think Strickland has a chance to be a really, like, a game-breaking talent. He was pretty much our top recruit in that class, and last year, you know, he got some carries here and there, and he seemed to do a lot with them, and just never really got fed the ball. And then Morris is back, and he's, you know, reliable if unspectacular. I'm sure he'll still have a role, and then you even have Mo Neal. Who knows if he'll be a running back or receiver, because I know he kind of fills the same role as Phillips. But I, you know, he may not get any touches, or he could be part of the offense from day one. He's on campus now. He has a big advantage over guys like Shaw because he's participating in spring. So there are a lot of potential carries to go around, and you know, McFarland read the tea leaves, died a couple days in practice, probably said, you know, this offense probably doesn't make the most sense for me, or I don't know where I fit in. So hopefully he has a good final season wherever he does end up, because I do think he's a talented player.
Yeah, and you know what? I think the good thing for McFarland, too, is that he can transfer and play next year because he is a redshirt senior. He has that option. I think that I'm not sure if he's an FBS back at the power conference level. I think that if there's a group of five team looking to add a running back, he might not be the worst option. I think FCS, he might get a bigger chance to just kind of shine right off the bat and put up the types of numbers that could potentially get him in position to be an NFL draft talk. I mean, who knows? That's not to knock him. I didn't really see NFL draft potential from him in his time at SU, but that doesn't mean he can't get there. I mean, stranger things have happened. But Dan, where do you see, I know you brought up two names we should probably touch on before signing off. Where do you see Tyrone Perkins, and where do you see Mo Neal kind of shaking out either this spring or going into the summer?
It's hard to know. I mean, we haven't heard a lot about them. I think we saw Neal doing drills with the running backs. I mean, Neal was such a productive runner in high school that I kind of hope he starts at running back, but there might be more room available at receiver. I think if he can play this year, you get him on the field and you can always, you know, cross train him and move him as you need. Perkins is a bit more of a wild card just because he wasn't as lauded as a recruit. He was, you know, a nice player, but he didn't have all the fanfare. But and obviously he's, you know, kind of a similar size. It wouldn't shock me if they looked for more at the receiver position, just because I think we do have a little more at depth at running back, especially once Shaw gets here. But it's tough to know. I mean, we're kind of going into this blind. We have a vague idea. We know what the offense is, but we don't know exactly how these things work out in terms of, you know, Babers as a head coach, how what his tendencies are and whatnot. So we're learning just as much as everyone else, I think, from a day-to-day basis. But I do trust him to get the guys in the right position, because he's proven that's what he's good at as a head coach. He's won everywhere. So I think it's almost a kind of a cop-out, but you really can't put too much doubt in Babers because he hasn't given us any reason to.
Agreed. Now you brought up a good point there, and we don't have to dive into it again, because, you know, we did about a month back. And that is, like, SU has had a different offense pretty much every year for, like, the last, what, 8 or 9. And that's alarming, but it leaves us fans and those of us who write about and cover the team always guessing and never really sure where people start to plug in. I mean, we can take educated guesses based on what we know about football and what we know about coach tendencies and player strengths, but at the end of the day, these are coach decisions and ones that, yeah, when it comes to Babers, I'm going to trust until I'm given a reason not to. I think people were slow to warm to that idea at the beginning of the Babers era, but I feel like people have just kind of figured it out now that, like, just because he's not Scott Schaefer, even to the most ardent Scott Schaefer supporters, doesn't mean that he's bad. And I think he's proven, if anything, that he's pretty good at what he does, and at least pretty good at knowing what he can do and what his system can do and how he can recruit talent to the program. I think we've seen plenty of that already in both the normal recruiting cycle as well as, you know, transfer Gabe Sherrod, who's we'll definitely talk about him when we get around to the defensive side of the ball next week, as well as Moore, who showed up. Well, he won't show up until the summer, but the JUCO transfer, who's got, I believe it's 3 years left, which is a nice bonus for us, especially at a position we need, like corner.
Three to play three, and he has good corner size. It sounds like he's still kind of growing into things, but if you can find a cornerback who can step in, you know, that's a really tough position to recruit, as we've seen. So I'm always down to take a shot on a slightly older cornerback.
Agreed. And based on what we've seen for SU, I think any and all help is welcome, even if we end up with the same players starting. At least there's a little more test and a little more competition to make sure we're getting the best players on the field.
Totally.
And on that note, I think we'll close out. Dan, thanks as always for joining. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, and we are a week from now. We'll be just. I think Syracuse will. What if we have one bye? What, when will we start playing? Wednesday or Thursday?
Thursday. I think Tuesday's just
Thursday.
Wait, maybe it's Wednesday. Wait, because the ACC ends on Saturday now, so it would have to be Wednesday.
Assuming we're like in that 5 to 8 range, which I don't know if that we could fall out of.
Yeah.
And we could apparently be as high as a 5 if, like, a lot of weird stuff happens.
I don't buy that, but
I don't think it requires. I think someone said it requires BC beating Clemson, isn't going to happen. But it sounds like we have a good shot of being in the 6. So that's, I don't know what the matchup equals there. But I mean, that's kind of cool, finishing 6th in the ACC, considering all the things. I'd take that, I guess.
I feel like it's probably Georgia.
There's not a lot of great options, but, you know, you take what you can. I guess I'd rather face Georgia Tech than, like, Virginia Tech.
Yeah, if I had to choose between the two Techs, I think Georgia Tech's the one to go with.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, we'll definitely be talking ACC tournament, actual seeding, and maybe a little bit more clarity on the NCAA tournament situation, too, even if not completely. So that'll be something fun to look forward to. That was Dan. I'm John. Thanks to everyone for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on Blog Talk, on iTunes, on whatever device or service you listen to us on. And go Orange this weekend.
Go Orange. Go Orange.